The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Hello and welcome to Talk Fertility, a show where we do just that, talk about fertility. I'm Natalie Silverman, host of the Fertility Podcast, which I launched in 2015, once successfully pregnant after having fertility treatment.
And I'm Kate Davis, a trained fertility nurse and founder of Your Fertility Journey, where I work one-to-one with women and couples to help them understand and optimise their fertility.
I'm really looking forward to the chat that we're going to be having, Kate, because I know it's something that both of us have a lot of people inquiring about, and that is unexplained infertility. Now, in the experience I've had with the podcast, I've spoken to a lot of people that have been told they have unexplained infertility. I have talked about it on the podcast in the past. I've got friends who have been told they've had unexplained infertility, and some of the conversations I've had from experts have said that they feel that unexplained infertility shouldn't even be a label because it just means that the problem is yet to be found.
Yes, I completely agree, and I think that's one of my top questions actually to ask Luciano when we chat to him is that, is unexplained fertility really unexplained, or do we just not have the science yet?
Because one of the things with our own fertility is it's also different, isn't it? And I heard a lovely like analogy with someone I was talking to about how it's like this kind of really weird lock that all you need is like one part to click round a bit more for it all to connect to then ideally get pregnant. But it's that bit that we're just still trying to get in place. So I get frustrated hearing people say they've been told unexplained infertility because I now know a lot more about this topic. And for anybody just starting out to be told that, it's kind of the most frustrating because there's no action points, are there?
No, I think there's nothing to fix. That's the problem. I mean, I think it's great when they find out that actually there's nothing wrong, but then there's the frustration that there's nothing actually to fix, which will then enable them to get pregnant quite quickly. I have a lot of ladies that will say to me, you know, Kate, I'm ovulating. I can see that I've ovulated. I've had sex around ovulation. Why am I not pregnant? So I'm kind of going back and saying, well, actually, there are so many different aspects that need to be 100% right. Your hormones need to be working absolutely correctly, that cycle. The egg quality needs to be fantastic on that egg. Equally, sperm quality needs to be super on that one occasion. It's so multifaceted. It's not just one thing. But the frustration that unexplained infertility creates is just unbelievable.
Well, we'll be putting Professor Luciano to the test with our questions, and we're always keen to hear your questions in Talk Fertility. You can email us talkfertility@gmail.com, and at the end of every episode we're doing our best to answer some of them, so do make sure you're listening to the end. So we're now going to welcome Professor Luciano Nordo to the show. He's the clinical director at the Reproductive Health Group to talk about unexplained infertility. Welcome, Luciano.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
And Kate and I have just been chatting about the kind of frustration that we talk to people when they are told that the issue is unexplained infertility. And we're going to talk a lot more about it. But as a starter, can you explain what unexplained infertility is? If somebody's listening and they've been to see a consultant and that's what they've been told, can you give us a bit more of a background answer to if they've not had the guts to say, what do you mean, you know, when they're sat in front of you? How do you explain it?
Well, unexplained subfertility is when no cause of subfertility has been found. Clearly, investigations have to be carried out in the first instance to identify a possible cause of fertility problems. And unexplained doesn't really stand when the patient comes for the first time to the clinic and say, we are fit and healthy and I got regular periods and we think we don't have a problem. I always tell my patients that in order for me to reassure them that there is no an underlying cause, then some basic investigations will have to be carried out on both partners. Unexplained is, to some extent for some patients, a comfort at the stage when they do not believe they need to embark on investigations or further investigations, or is also used in some instances as a cause to delay embarking on IVF treatment. We always make sure that the couple has had 12 consecutive months of unprotected sexual intercourse, and clearly history for both female and male partner is taken. And if there are concerns about the fertility potential, then that is the first instance when it's no longer unexplained. Normally, we would be recommending that investigations such as a semen analysis and for the man, a pelvic ultrasound scan and a hormone profile for the female are done. If these tests come back as normal, again, doesn't reassure them that there's no problem, but simply that the tests that we carried out have failed to demonstrate a non-cause of fertility problems.
So, Luciano, what I'm really interested in is do you think that unexplained infertility really is unexplained, or do we just not yet have the science to identify the problem?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think unexplained infertility exists. I think that we don't have all the diagnostic tools to identify all the fertility problems. And the percentage of couples that I see in my clinic today, in 2019, with a possible unexplained subfertility is significantly smaller than the percentage of couples I used to see 10 years ago and 15 years ago, simply because the technology, the clinical tools and the laboratory tools have enabled me and professionals like me sitting in clinics to identify some causes of subfertility that were not at the time a known problem. And they're no longer accepted as being unexplained.
So have you got kind of examples of, or could you tell us a bit more about the technology that you use that you now use that you didn't use previously?
Yeah, so an example is a test called sperm DNA fragmentation test. We know that men with high DNA damage, for whatever reason they have high DNA damage in the sperm, they are more likely than not to suffer from subfertility, and if they do get their partners pregnant, then to experience a miscarriage. So relying only on a semen analysis is perhaps too simplistic when it comes to a clinical setting and sitting in front of a patient and say, well, you don't have a problem. I could say the semen analysis shows that you have normal sperm parameters, but I cannot say if the sperm is healthy enough to fertilize successfully an egg. So this is an example. So a percentage of men that used to come to clinic with a normal semen analysis and they will say, well, you don't have a problem. Actually, they do have a problem, but we needed additional tests to demonstrate what the problem is.
So with a test like that sperm DNA fragmentation test, is that likely to be something that is only suggested once a cycle has failed, or is it if there's not enough information in that early sperm test?
I don't think at that stage we are talking about embarking on any fertility treatment cycles. It's just the fertility journey as a diagnostic test. Okay. So we normally would recommend men that embark on a fertility journey as coming to the clinic and not being able to conceive with their partners for 12 consecutive months, not just to have a semen analysis, but we combine the semen analysis with the sperm DNA fragmentation test so to gain more information about sperm parameters but also the sperm potential.
And in your clinic, how many couples with a diagnosis of unexplained infertility will go on to conceive either naturally or with IVF, would you say?
Well, there are two different, obviously, approaches. Mm. So we know about 20-25% of couples with unknown factors of subfertility, they end up conceiving naturally. So that is about one in five will conceive naturally. But we also know that 50% of couples with unexplained subfertility will conceive via means of IVF. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone having unexplained subfertility will need IVF. Because sometimes, you know, it's a matter of time, it's a numbers game. But there are issues associated with the sperm or the eggs that can be overcome by IVF. And I'm afraid they're not found to be a problem until they embark on IVF. So for that specific reason, I always advise my patient saying that IVF treatment is not really a treatment, because you cannot expect an outcome. You want to have a positive outcome, but there's not always the outcome you expect, unlike other areas of medicine where the treatment is linked with a positive outcome. But for IVF itself, is a therapeutic approach to shorten the time to pregnancy. But in some cases, it's also a diagnostic approach, because it enables us to look at the eggs, see the potential of the eggs being fertilized, and enables us to look into the embryo quality and also the genetic makeup of some embryos. And we have found many cases of subfertility or unexplained subfertility as being associated with genetic abnormalities on either the female or the male partner. That is the same as a miscarriage. Miscarriage and unexplained subfertility are different faces of the same coin, just depends what time the pregnancy ends or that the embryo doesn't implant.
Just out of interest, in your clinic, how much would you look into possibility of male issues? So, for example, varicocele, for example, how much do you go into that? Or do you tend to go straight into IVF? Okay.
Not right. All the time. In fact, we are actually in the process of setting up a completely separate service where we'll be looking at the man as a standalone patient and not just part of the couple.
That's great. That is fantastic to hear, because that is sometimes so much the issue, that it's often the woman that is focused on and not the man. So to actually have that ability to really focus on the man, I think is so beneficial. It's great that you're doing that.
But we are doing it in an innovative way. And what we are thinking to do is actually establishing contacts with patients, or establishing the first consultation with patients, not being a face-to-face consultation, where there is perhaps in some cases the fear of being stigmatized as having a male fertility problem. We're giving them the opportunity to have a remote access to consultant andrologists to discuss their lifestyle, to discuss their fertility and medical health, and inviting them then for a semen analysis and a sperm DNA fragmentation test and an examination. So they will be made aware of the potential factors that affect fertility first, then invited to have tests and examination afterwards.
It's really interesting. I mean, with that in mind, you're talking about those kind of remote consultations, and I know that you're really keen to get as much information, clear, concise information out to people. Are you finding patients are more informed when they're coming to you? Because we know there's so much more online now, but I know that you have issue with it being conflicting information.
Absolutely. I think patients are very well informed before they come to a fertility specialist. And sometimes patients are aware and of potential underlying problems, but they perhaps are directed towards IVF or other techniques before looking into the underlying problem. Hence why we believe that investigating the couple fully prior to embarking on any fertility treatment is going to shorten the time to pregnancy.
On that note then, because this is a question I get asked quite a lot, is do you recommend ovulation induction for women with unexplained infertility, particularly if they're ovulating, or would you go straight for IVF in that situation?
No, I would not recommend. If they ovulate, I wouldn't recommend ovulation induction, because by definition, ovulation induction means inducing ovulation. So if a woman already ovulates, then there's no benefit. In fact, there are more risks with ovulation induction. So for instance, women taking Clomid, they have an increased risk of multiple pregnancy. Clomid is an anti-estrogen, so will reduce the thickness of the endometrium. And there have been studies in the literature. In fact, one of the largest and most recent studies was the Scottish collaborative study showing that women embarking on ovulation induction and ovulating would have less chance of success than women not embarking on ovulation induction.
That sounds really interesting. Yeah.
So I would definitely not recommend ovulation induction for anyone with a diagnosis of unexplained subfertility, bearing in mind that I would not even say that they have unexplained subfertility until some investigations have been carried out.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, the reason I ask that is I sometimes see women who have been given Clomid, even though they're ovulating. And I kind of get really quite confused about this sometimes. And they're often told that taking Clomid, for example, could produce a better quality ovulation.
No, I don't think so. No.
Okay.
I think, and this is not just, I see these patients myself in clinic. They may have been given 6 months of Clomid just to be discharged from a clinical setting.
Right.
But it's not the right approach. As I said, sometimes it's not going to shorten the time to pregnancy at all, and some other times actually increase the risk of complications as a result of Clomid.
Okay, thank you.
One of the things that we see when people are dealing with unexplained infertility is like the emotional toll and the impact of it not having a fix. And keen to just know whether you think unexplained infertility may be caused by emotional factors as well as physical, whether if people are, you know, driving themselves mad about the fact that it's not happening, and we know that there are some links to stress, we know the impact that it has on mental health, not being able to conceive, but without just wanting to tell people to relax because we don't want to make it that black and white. How do you feel about that side of things?
I think I firmly believe that emotional factors can impact on both men and women's ability to conceive, as well as impact on the relationship and sexual life. I think it's a bit difficult to determine whether the emotional factors are a consequence of the difficulty in conceiving, or in some cases could be contributing to the subfertility. And I think subfertility and the intention to conceive, they bring expectations. And everyone that has got expectations will inevitably have an element of emotional disturbance or emotional distress. But generally, patients that come to our clinic, and you can clearly say that they are emotionally affected by being childless, we would recommend to consider counseling and fertility coaching and alternative measures before embarking on IVF treatment, simply because IVF is a very stressful and emotionally demanding journey. And I have seen on numerous occasions patients that actually are relaxed are more likely to succeed through IVF simply because they can face the disappointment of a failed cycle. If they have instead high expectations and they are emotionally distressed and they embark on IVF because time is of the essence, they're more likely than not to give up after one failed cycle.
Lucia, that was really interesting. When you mentioned about having fertility coaches, which I'm assuming you've got in your clinic, apart from being a nurse, fertility nurse consultant, I'm a fertility coach, and Natalie is also training to be a coach. And I absolutely love coaching. I think it's a fantastic for the fertility journey. What's your kind of thought process on coaching and counselling, and how they differ and how they can both support patients? And which do you have any experience of which you find better?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, so the two, I think the counselling is normally recommended when patients need some support as a result of a failure.
Okay.
I think fertility coaching, or generally life coaching, is to build confidence, to help human beings to be positive, not just to make them a reason why something has failed. And hence why in clinic, we recommend fertility coaching at the very beginning of the journey and counselling as a way to support their emotional well-being.
Well, that's great to hear, because I think it's quite unusual for clinics to offer both. And as we know, counselling can be quite, you know, limited because of resources within clinics. So, yeah, to be able to offer both, and as Natalie said, to be able to offer coaching that early. How many sessions of coaching or counselling would your patients get within the clinic?
I would say probably three.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah.
And when it comes to that label of unexplained infertility, do you think that we're too quick? Obviously, you've just described how you operate in your clinic, but as an industry as a whole, do you think that there's too much haste in giving this subfertile, however we want to call it, label to people? And what advice would you give to people who might be listening who have that label and are trying to navigate their way through it?
Yeah, I think we are very quick in stigmatizing, or as you say, labeling patients with fertility problems, simply because this area of medicine is a choice. It's not really essential medicine. You wouldn't be labeling or in most cases you wouldn't be labeling somebody having a disease unless you've carried out all the investigations and made a firm diagnosis of that person having a problem. So yes, indeed, we are very quick in labeling somebody with subfertility or saying actually it's unexplained, perhaps without having carried out all the investigations, or indeed finding one problem, believing that IVF will overcome it. Because we know that in some cases it might be multifactorial. So as a principle, I will never say to my patient population, this is the only problem you got. I will never say to my patient population, IVF is the only treatment that will lead to a successful outcome. And I will try to, that is where I think fertility coaching helps as well, because it helps them to understand the balance between their own fertility potential and what fertility treatment such as IVF can add to it. So in generally, we are very quick in labeling patients with subfertility, and we are even quicker in recommending IVF treatment.
What, yes.
What do you mean when you said about it being a choice, Luciano, just about, were you talking about the treatment?
No, I think the whole fertility journey is a choice. Women and men choose to have a family, and like right. others choose not to have a family. Right. So they don't really have to embark on fertility treatment because they've only identified a problem. They may embark on fertility treatment because, yes, they want to have a family. But in most cases, we should really explore all the possible causes of subfertility. And I'll just make reference to something actually I see weekly in my clinic. Most same-sex lesbian couples attending to clinic, they go either for donor insemination or straight onto IVF using donor sperm. Now, there is a potential for this patient population to have underlying problems. And it cannot be said, well, IVF is the only option or donor insemination is the only option and will lead to a successful outcome simply because they haven't got an heterosexual partner, as they would have the same increased risk of or incidence of fertility problems as any other woman. Simply, they've not been exposed to the chances of pregnancy. So we have patients coming to clinic with failed donor insemination cycles or donor IVF cycles, and we identify perhaps even later than in a normal fertile heterosexual general population, some fertility problem could have been diagnosed before.
I'm really passionate about in my work and what I do is about natural fertility and offering women as much information and advice and support as I possibly can to hopefully help them avoid IVF, but clearly that's not possible for some couples and that is often their only route. But do you think we should offer couples with unexplained infertility expectant management to include more support and advice on achieving pregnancy naturally, particularly around lifestyle and identifying, for example, the fertile time? I don't know how much time you spend in clinic with your patients or your staff do on those aspects.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's very useful if any fertility clinic would have a panel of nutritionists or life coaches and counselors and non-IVF specialists. In that case, I'm sure that women will receive more adequate and prompt advice on how to achieve a healthy pregnancy naturally. In our clinic, we do have nutritionists as well as life and fertility coaches and counselors. And patients are advised to seek advice by a nutritionist as well as a life coach before embarking on IVF treatment, especially if they have, they're young, they have had all the basic investigations and everything has come back as normal. I think they need to have some reassurance about their own fertility potential. So in that specific case, I do believe that there is a benefit. Of course, nothing is black and white in medicine. So the time to offer nutrition advice or life coaching to a lady in her late 30s probably is not the same as offering lifestyle advice and fertility coach to somebody who's in the late 20s or early 30s. So we have to bear in mind also what are the reasons and underlying factors why they've not been able to conceive.
Okay, that sounds great. It sounds fantastic that you're offering this.
I just want to pick up, Luciano, if I may, on the really interesting point you made with regards to the same-sex couples, especially when you were saying about women coming through if it is donor insemination. And I guess what we're trying to get across is that education about your fertility and the issues that could be affecting it that could then create problems. And is that information out there, do you think, when it comes to if you're in a lesbian relationship, to think about your own fertility? Or is it just, if you want to have a baby, you go to a clinic? There's not that you need to think about these things first enough.
Yeah, I think perhaps like male fertility, we as a society have not really been spending much time on educating some fertile patient populations. And I think amongst those, we have got the same-sex lesbian couples. And more information could be made available to other members of the public and healthcare professionals, so to help same-sex and lesbian couples to receive adequate information about the future fertility potential. We see often patients coming in a same-sex relationship and requesting a specific treatment simply because they don't know of an alternative. We see couples coming and having that idea already in their mind that one of the two partners is definitely going to be the, you know, egg donor, because they don't understand the impact of age, or in some cases the importance of investigating the ovarian reserve before they make that informed decision. And I see that in my practice, same-sex lesbian couples coming to clinic and say, well, yes, she's going to be the one actually using her eggs, but it may be she's not adequate. Maybe she's older. Maybe her ovarian reserve is not good. Maybe that she has got an underlying genetic problem. So why don't you understand what are the factors that ultimately are going to impact on your chance of success before you make that decision? And I think the reason why some women, they don't understand this, because there's not much information out there, and they believe that the only reason why they need to come to a fertility clinic is to have donor insemination or donor IVF.
A really important point to get across. Just finally, Luciano, because we are focusing on the unexplained infertility point. If a couple are coming to you with that diagnosis, maybe they've had a failed cycle, and they're asking about add-ons, they're asking about treatment add-ons, which we know is a contentious issue, where do you sit with that? I mean, what do you do with somebody coming with you saying, we've heard that could help?
I think it's a very difficult question for me as a professional when patients come to clinic and say, we've heard that any add-on can help. And unfortunately, there's no enough evidence to say that they can help, but equally, there's no enough evidence to say that they will not help. And I think in some cases, it could be wrong to say to patients, well, I think you should not take this, or you should not use it, or you should not have this add-on, simply because there's not enough evidence that to support the benefit, because the counter argument is, well, there's not enough evidence to demonstrate actually it's not work, doesn't work, or there's not enough evidence to demonstrate it's going to be harmful. So we always say to patients coming to clinic that they can use some add-ons. The evidence is in most cases limited, but as long as they are safe and they have no consequences on the mother nor on the fetus, then they can certainly use add-ons. But itself, IVF is an add-on to natural conception. And we know that IVF doesn't work all the time either.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, if you think about the very nature of IVF, right at the very beginning with Louise Brown, it was experimental. And look where we've come. Look where we've come in those 40-odd years from an experimental procedure, which effectively, you know, ideally, I guess you could say that some of these add-ons may well be looked at, viewed in the same light. But look where we've moved in 40 years from what was the original experimental procedure. So I guess the whole nature of IVF medicine
is experimental, and as I said, as long as it's safe and doesn't have any long or short or medium term consequences on the health of the mother and the fetus, then I don't think there is a reason why to say, no, actually, you should not take it.
No, absolutely.
Thank you, Luciano. That's been really enlightening. I think there's a lot of points there that will be really useful to people, because it's just such a frustrating label that we know many, many people sadly have to try and get their head around. As a final words of wisdom, would you say that if people are told that, just to challenge it a bit more? ask for more tests?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if couples or individuals are told that they have a normal fertility, despite still not being able to conceive, they should ask for all the tests that are available in order to help them make an informed decision whether actually they will be pursuing a treatment, which in some cases is expensive, but also emotionally draining and could put, as we know already, could put some patients into a category that will be stigmatized by families and friends if they're not able to achieve a pregnancy.
Well, thank you for explaining, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. That was so interesting.
That was an interesting conversation with Luciano, wasn't it?
It was fab. It was so, so good to understand.
We were saying.
Yeah, massively refreshing to understand a bit more about unexplained infertility, and actually to hear him say that he doesn't put that label on his patients straight away. You know, he does everything he possibly can to identify a problem, because as we know, it's so frustrating to not have a problem that can be fixed. So it's fantastic that he's able to really hold back on putting that label on, if you like.
If you also haven't heard the episode that we did the week before we spoke to Luciano, which was about a film called Only You, we were speaking to the director, Harry. There was a brilliant example of a couple being rushed into fertility treatment, and that's exactly what we were kind of hoping that would come out of, I suppose, that conversation with Luciano, that because unexplained, you don't want to just be fast-tracked into fertility treatment. You want to understand what's going on and have every chance possible to conceive naturally, don't you?
Yes. And so, you know, when I asked him about expectant management and looking at lifestyle and nutrition, you know, that absolutely, that's something that in his clinic they're really, really positive on, and make sure that all of their patients have that access, which I think is fantastic and so refreshing.
Definitely. Right. Okay. So now it's time to get some more questions answered, which is something that we like to do here at Talk Fertility. Not only do we like to bring you experts so you can understand more about what might be going on with you or the questions that you can ask if you're going through treatment and you are having these kind of conversations, but if you're just trying to work out what's going on, we ask you to email us, talkfertility@gmail.com. And with Kate's background as a fertility nurse, we put her to the test. So we've got a couple more questions.
Yeah, so we've had one here on about vitamin D, and it's a really interesting one, because this lady is asking that, well, it turns out that she's got quite low vitamin D levels, but she feels healthier now than she's ever been before, and kind of wants to know how important vitamin D is for fertility. So the Department of Health recommend that all women, or in fact all adults in the UK, should be taking vitamin D supplements, and that's because we just don't have enough sunshine. Yeah, just always. So even if you're not trying to conceive, particularly as well, children and the elderly need to be on it because their levels can be quite low. But yeah, all adults, that's what they recommend. And for pregnant women. So clearly, if you're trying to conceive, it's really important you take vitamin D. And there is some research to suggest that vitamin D, or good levels of vitamin D, have almost, if you like, fertility boosting properties. So they do play an important role in fertility. Right now, we've been really lucky. We've had a few days of nice sunshine. So getting outside and soaking up that sun is a really, really good way of boosting your vitamin D levels up. But you should absolutely be taking a supplement on a daily basis. And there are various different types of supplements that you can take for vitamin D. You take it in tablet form, or there's some evidence suggests that taking it in a spray or a droplet form is absorbed better, and therefore it's a bit more of a superior type of supplement.
Okay.
So another question we've had is on AMH. So AMH is the test, anti-Müllerian hormone test, that is used for women who to check their ovarian reserve. And lady's had a test. She says here that she had her bloods back and that it was 14.4. And the clinic has said that it's good, but she wants to know how good and what's the scale. She's finding conflicting information everywhere and wanted to find out a bit more about it. Now, actually, that question is quite difficult for me to answer, because AMH is all based on age. So without knowing her age, I can't work out whether her AMH level of 14.4 is good or not. Okay. So, for example, a woman who is 25 AMH is quite difficult to work out a kind of an average, but an average would be having an AMH of about 25. A woman who's 45, an average would, well, say a woman who's 40, would an average would be about 4. But there's a whole range and scale that women can be on. You know, that's kind of the very good right in the middle, but it can also be not, you know, slightly lower or slightly higher and still be relatively within normal range. So unfortunately, sorry, but I can't answer that question. But if you give us a bit more information on how old you are, then I will happily answer it for you.
Okay. So when you are getting in touch with questions, do, like, you don't have to give us your name, they can be anonymous, but do give us as much information as possible, age, how long maybe you've been trying, so that we can try and answer, as you just heard. It's not often that Kate struggles to answer a question, so we wouldn't want that to be a regular occurrence.
No.
Okay, well, look, thank you for your time with our show this week. We love hearing from you, so please do get in touch. You can follow me on my socials at Fertility Poddy. That's what I am on Insta and on Twitter.
Or you can follow me at Your Fertility Journey on Instagram and the same on Facebook.
Now, if you've listened to previous episodes of our Talk Fertility radio show, you'll know that I like to delve into my back catalogue of the Fertility Podcast, which you can do via thefertilitypodcast.com, or you can subscribe via your favourite podcast app, because for the last 5 years, I've been interviewing a whole range of experts, as well as sharing stories with men and women talking about their infertility struggles. And I referred earlier in this conversation with Professor Luciano to having spoken about unexplained infertility on my podcast, which there's a search box on my website. You can type it in and see some of the chats. And this is one that I had with Dr. Jane Stewart, who is based in the Newcastle Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust. And she's also the chair of the British Fertility Society. And I wanted to get Jane's views on this diagnosis of subfertility or unexplained fertility. Here's what she said, and you can have a listen to the full episode at thefertilitypodcast.com. Jane, are you seeing more cases of unexplained infertility as a couple's diagnosis or an individual's?
I think we see a fair number of couples with unexplained subfertility. Whether that's increasing, I'm not sure. But I think people are coming to have assessments probably more commonly now. And therefore, we're investigating people at an early stage to be able to exclude other diagnoses. Of course, some of those people then are normal. They have normal investigations, and depending on how long they've been trying for a pregnancy, we might either give them that horrid label of unexplained subfertility or indeed let them go because they're actually okay.
Just explain subfertility to me.
Yes, so subfertility is a term really that just recognises that most people aren't absolutely infertile. In other words, most couples will have the chance of conceiving. It's whether there's something that's reducing that chance that we can make a diagnosis of, or in terms of unexplained subfertility, where they've been trying for a decent length of time where most people would have been expected to conceive, and therefore there's a risk that there's something else going on that perhaps we can't usefully test for.
From the people that I've spoken to that have been diagnosed with unexplained infertility, it's quite a frustrating one because you've just not got any idea where to start. You don't know if there's a certain thing to pinpoint. So it's how do you then move on without just initially thinking the only option is to have fertility treatment?
So you're right, it's a dreadful thing, and actually it's not a diagnosis at all, it is just a label. It's a label to say you should have conceived by now, so maybe there's something else going on that we can't explain. I think the value of having that label is that it does recognise that A, we don't know everything, but B, there may be something going on that's hindering your chances, and therefore it is worthwhile considering your options from the point of view of treatment. But it also doesn't mean that you can't conceive, and many couples with so-called unexplained subfertility will go on and conceive successfully at a later stage. And conception is all about time. You know, humans aren't brilliant at making successful pregnancies. It takes time. And even with things that aren't optimal, there is still the possibility of getting there. So not everybody needs to go down the route of treatment if they don't want to.
Which is really reassuring to hear, because I think that's the kind of conclusion that people instantly jump to. So say you've just spoken with a couple and they've maybe been trying for, I don't know, maybe a year, and maybe they're both mid-30s and this is the term or the label that they're being given at this stage. Are there some steps that you would initially tell them to consider? First and foremost, probably trying to have sex more often, would you say?
Well, I would start by saying actually they don't have have that label if they've only been trying for a year.
Oh, right.
But they've still got plenty of scope to conceive in the second year of trying, and I wouldn't give them that label until they've been trying for 2 years.
Okay.
Because 95% of couples in that situation will do so if they've had normal tests. So I would investigate them at a year, absolutely. But if their tests are normal, they don't have that unexplained subfertility unless they've also been trying for a couple of years. So that's where this issue about a diagnosis comes in. It's more to do with a diagnosis of exclusion, if you like. You test for things, you make sure they're normal. If they're normal, actually, you can reassure them. And whilst it's really hard to take that reassurance, if you desperately wanted a child, you wanted a child a year ago, it's horrid, horrid waiting. One of the best bits of advice I can give people is to be prepared to be reassured and be glad that they don't actually necessarily need to go down the route of treatment at the moment, and save the horrible things for later if they really, really need it. In the meantime, though, there are things that they can do, of course, is to make sure that they're healthy and that they're not smoking, not drinking too much, doing all the things they need to do to keep fit and well. But without getting too hung up about some of the sort of quasi bits of advice that come through. So I try very hard to reassure people most of the time.
And I'm quite interested in the investigations at this stage that have been done on the man, because from our own experience, the standard semen analysis was done, and we ended up having to have ICSI as a result of that. And several years later, my husband and I were sat in front of a urologist with this podcast, urologist Jonathan Ramsey, who I'm sure you're familiar with, who actually talked about examining my husband, which is something that nobody had ever done. And he took him off and examined him. And it was a really interesting thing to discuss, because that seems like such an obvious thing that could be done in the early stages, but isn't. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, it isn't always isn't. But if there's a sperm problem, then it's worthwhile exploring. So in a man who needs ICSI, that means he didn't have a normal sperm test in the first place, which means it wasn't an unexplained diagnosis,
sure,
an unexplained label. If a man has a normal sperm test, the chance of finding a pathology that's going to improve his fertility is, I think, relatively small. And so people will often stop at just doing the sperm test.
Right.
Of course, quite a lot of work now being done looking at details of those sperm tests, and in a detailed sperm test will include the numbers, the movement of the sperm, the morphology, how the sperm look. So we're looking at it in quite a detailed way, but that doesn't tell you everything about sperm. And so things like DNA fragmentation, sperm function tests, which have come and gone over years, are interesting things. And if you're finding those kind of things, you've then got to think about what might cause it and whether or not you can correct any of that. But at the moment, we don't have really good evidence for all of that. It's coming. And I think there's much, much more work being done in male infertility now that hopefully will begin to garner that kind of information, but we haven't really got a handle on it. And a lot of fertility treatment, or a lot of fertility management, if you like, is pragmatic, because bottom line is people want to have a baby, not a diagnosis. So we could spend ages looking at erudite things, checking out hormones, seeing if there's a little bit here, something going on there, but actually, unless it's going to make a difference and help to with the process of conception, in some ways it's academic. So it's important from a research point of view. We need to increase our understanding of all of those things, but at the moment one of the better options is to say, well, actually we'll just get on and treat the problem, and when there's a mild problem, you might then just end up doing ICSI because we haven't got something else to correct.
Okay. Are there standard, and I don't really want to use the word standard, but are there reoccurring, let's say, questions that couples that you're seeing who have this label put on them are asking? We've talked about diet and things that they can do to improve their chances.
People will often come with things that they've read. So they'll sometimes ask if there are other things that they can do that will make a difference. So they may already have been doing acupuncture and reflexology and all of those kind of things. They're sometimes already taking a whole myriad of vitamins. They're sometimes already taking things that Chinese herbalists have given them. They've sometimes have been told about particular diets. So what I try and do is just unpack some of those and talk about what they mean and what the evidence is or isn't, whether it's likely to have an effect or be harmful, try and give them some useful advice about that. But a lot of what people ask about is targeting intercourse. People always want, and quite understandably, you want to fix something. So there's always this, what can we do? How can we make this into a program of work that's going to make a difference?
Sure.
And what I try really hard to do for people who genuinely have got normal tests and haven't just exhausted their own chances, in other words, we haven't quite gotten that label 2 yet, is just to try to take some of that out of the equation again and allow them to be normal and allow them to recognise that actually they're not doing anything wrong, there's nothing that really exciting that they can make a difference with, but that time is okay and there is still a chance to come back and talk about things if it hasn't happened for the few where that might be the case.
Because do you think, I mean, I've been doing this podcast now for 3 years, and when I started doing it, I was constantly talking about infertility being a taboo word. And now it feels that we're talking about it so much more. There's much more discussion in the media and there's much more on social media. And I wonder whether that's almost making people panic more when they are trying and say a year's gone by and they know this whole fertility world is out there now because it is talked about so much. Do you see that panic from people?
Yeah, I do, but I don't think that's necessarily to do with the hype so much as just the fact that, you know, when you start to try to conceive, I've said already that 95% of people under 35 will conceive within the first 2 years of trying, but actually 75% of them will conceive within the first 6 months. So what they're seeing is all the people around them getting pregnant. Mm. And they haven't got there yet. So you can see, I can understand very well why people get anxious about that. Why has it not happened for us? So it's understanding what's normal, which is really important. And to give them that reassurance that actually another 75% of the people that haven't got pregnant will get pregnant in the next 18 months. So, and if and therefore they're likely to be in that group. And it's just accepting that that's the difficulty. People do worry about it. I think perhaps the biggest anxiety that's coming through is this thing about age and delaying, because there's a lot of discussion about that, isn't there, and storing eggs in case and you know, leaving it too late and just all of that. There's a lot of discussion about it, and I think that does cause some anxieties. And so reminding people that there isn't a fertility treatment that is better than what they can do on their own if they're normal is actually quite important.
We are going to be having more fascinating chats coming up. We're going to be talking about childlessness, which sadly is again a conversation that needs to happen more and needs to be less stigmatized. If you have been going through treatment and been trying to conceive and have had to accept that maybe your hopes aren't going to come into fruition and want to get your head around that plan B, then we've got some brilliant conversations happening about where the support is and how you can still find joy and still have an amazing life even if it hasn't turned out quite how you'd hoped. And up next is the Robert Scott Bell Show.